Anantagodavaishnavavrindakija. Namacharya Haridastako Kija. Pramsaka Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda. Sri Dvaita Gadadhar Sivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrindakija. Sri Sri Radha Krishna Gopa Gopinath. Shama Kunda Radha Kunda Giri Gobadan Kija. Sri Vrindavan Dham Kija. Sri Matada Dham Kija. Sri Navadvip Mayapur Dham Kija. Ganga Mai Ki Jai, Jamuna Mai Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai, Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaura Premanani. All glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, Gaura Premanani. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Okay, so we're on Canto 10, Chapter 2, Prayers by the Demigods, Text Number 33. Taha Nate Madhava Tavakaha Kvachid Rasyanti Maragat Twai Badasoridaha Twaya Bigupta Bicharanti Nirbadaya Vinayakantikapa Murdashu Prabho Titanete Madhava Tavaka Kvachid Rasyanti Margat Twai Bada Sorida Twaya Bigupta Bicharanti Nirbada Vinayakani Kapa Murashu Prabhu Tatanate Madhava Tavaka Kvachid Rasyanti Margat Twai Bada Sorida Twaya Bigupta Vicharanti Nirbhaya Vinayakani Kapa Murdashu Prabhu Rasyanti Margat Twai Bada Sorida Gupta Vicharanti Nibada Vinayakanika Super Bowl Tatanate ladies. Tata, like them, the non-devotees. Na, not. Te, they, the devotees. Madhava, O Lord, husband of the goddess of fortune. Tavakaha, the followers of the devotional path. The devotees. Quachit, in any circumstances. Prasyanti, fall down. Margat, from the path of devotional service. Twayi, unto you. Badasauridaha, because of being fully attached to your lotus feet. Twaya, by you. Abhiguptaha, always protected from all dangers. Vicharanti, they move. Nirbhaya, without fear. Vinayaka, anikapa. The enemies who maintain paraphernalia to oppose the Bhakti cult. Sorry about that. Murdishu on their heads. Prabho, O Lord. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. O Madhava, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord of the Goddess of Fortune, if devotees completely in love with you sometimes fall from the path of devotion, they do not fall like non-devotees, for you still protect them. Thus they fearlessly traverse the heads of their opponents and continue to progress in devotional service. Please repeat. O Madhava, Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord of the Goddess of Fortune, if devotees completely in love with you sometimes fall from the path of devotion, they do not fall like non-devotees, for you still protect them. Thus they fearlessly traverse the heads of their opponents and continue to progress in devotional service. Purport. Devotees generally do not fall down, but if circumstantially they do, the Lord, because of their strong attachment to Him, gives them protection in all circumstances. Thus, even if the devotees fall down, they are still strong enough to traverse the heads of their enemies. We have actually seen that our Krishna consciousness movement has many opponents, such as the deprogrammers, who instituted a strong legal case against the devotees. We thought that this case would take a long time to settle, but because the devotees were protected by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, we unexpectedly won the case in one day. Thus a case that was expected to continue for years was settled in one day because of the protection of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who has promised in the Bhagavad Gita 9.31, Kantiya Pratijanihi Name Bhakta Pranasyati. O son of Kunti, declare it boldly that my devotees never perish. In history, there are many instances of devotees like Chitraketu, Indrajumna, and Maharaj Bharat, who circumstantially fell down, but was still protected. Maharaj Bharat, for example, because of his attachment to a deer, thought of the deer at the time of death, and therefore in his next life, he became a deer. Yam yam vapi smaram bhavam, chajat yante kalevaram. Because of protection by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, however, the deer remembered his relationship with the Lord and next took birth in a good brahminical family and performed devotional service. Suchinam Srimatam Gehe Yoga Brashto Bijayate. Similarly, Chitraketu fell down and became a demon, Vritrasura, but he too was protected. Thus, even if one falls down from the path of back to yoga, one is ultimately saved. If a devotee is strongly situated in devotional service, the Supreme Personality of Godhead has promised to protect him. Kantiya Pratijani Name Bhakta Pranasyati. But even if a devotee circumstantially falls down, he is protected by Madhava. The word Madhava is significant. Ma, Mother Lakshmi, the mother of all opulences, is always with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And if a devotee is in touch with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, all the opulences of the Lord are ready there to help him. Yatra Yogeshvara Krishna Yatra Parato Danodara Tatra Shri Vijayo Bhutya Dhruva Nitya Mati Mama. Bhagavad Gita 18.78. Wherever there is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, and his devotee, Arjuna, Bharata, there is victory, opulence, extraordinary power, and morality. The opulences of a devotee are not a result of karmakanda vichar. A devotee is always protected by all of the Supreme Lord's opulences, of which no one can deprive him. Tesham nichabhiyuktanam yogakshemam bhamyaham. Thus, a devotee cannot be defeated by any opponents. A devotee, therefore, should not deviate knowingly from the path of devotion. The adherent devotee is assured all protection from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. All right, so this is Krishna's guarantee. If we take up devotional service, we can never be the loser. There are people, many demons in this material world. That's what it's there for. It's like going to jail. Everybody's guilty. Yeah, they're all rascals and demonic personalities. So when somebody offends the devotees of the Lord, then Krishna himself, or through an agency of Krishna's, he makes sure that the devotee is upheld and that the demons are vanquished. Prabhupada mentions here about the deprogrammers. Is there anybody here that remembers the deprogrammers? All right, not so many, one or two. That was a phenomenon that appeared in the 1970s. when Prabhupada started his preaching, then nobody really, you know, recognized who he was. He just was like some old Indian Swami who was singing some songs, and that was it. But they didn't realize that Prabhupada was more powerful than any demigod or demon in the universe, practically, because he had the full shelter of Krishna. So Prabhupada used to laugh about that sometimes, that he used to tell us, if they knew what I had really come for, they would never have allowed me in the country. So he used that, in like a needle, out like a plow. That was his preaching. Very subtle. Prabhupada was a very gentle person, gentleman. People liked him very much. But later on, as they started to realize what was going on, that he meant to destroy the materialistic civilization and replace that with the Varnashram civilization, then they became a little afraid. So they started some tactics to drive us out. I remember, Prabhupada mentions this deprogrammers in the Korean War. Sometimes the Koreans, North Koreans, they would capture some American soldier, and then they would do what they call program them, so that after a short while, then the person would be put on the TV denouncing America. They would get an American serviceman, army or, you know, airplanes or whatever, and they would brainwash them. That was another new term that came out at that time, brainwashing. So they would try to convert the soldiers into supporting North Korea. And once they'd broken them mentally, then they'd put them on the TV and have them denounce America. So that was reprogramming. So the same with our devotees. When we started chanting and dancing on the streets, it's an innocuous activity. You'd think that people would like to see other people chanting and dancing. Yeah, but there's a group of men, demons, that didn't like it. As soon as they heard the holy name, as soon as they saw the devotees, they got an instant hatred and tried to somehow or another break the movement. So that breaking, that's called deprogramming. So they compared what they were doing. They were parents of devotees. They were actually not just our devotees, but there was a number of groups that were set up specifically to stop any symptom of new, what they call the new religious groups. They wanted to somehow or another do away with us. So for a number of years, they would attack the devotees. They even managed to get the American court system on their side. They would go to court and they would say, this is my son or daughter when he was normal. They'd give a photograph, and then they'd show a photograph with them shaved head or saris and tilak. So now they've been ruined by this group. So although most of the devotees were over 16, that means that they were legally, you know, justified in doing it, following whatever religion they liked, say whatever they liked according to the American Constitution. These deprogrammers and parents, they tried to work around the First Amendment, and somehow or another they would try to break the faith of these devotees. So one or two of the devotees that were captured, they would get a court order from the legal system that they could keep them imprisoned for 1 month. And then in that 1 month, they would try their best to break the faith of the devotees. So there were quite a number. By 1976, there was quite a number of these groups in operation. When Prabhupada visited Los Angeles in June of 76, during the Sunday program, there was a group of these disgruntled parents who were marching up and down the street and demanding that their children be set free. Later on, they managed to bring a court case against the devotees. that was in New York. So Prabhupada was in October of 1976, he was in Chandigarh, and that was the first that we heard about this deprogramming. There was some press conference that he held, and in the press conference, one of the reporters, he asked Srila Prabhupada, what about this accusation by these people, parents in America, that you're brainwashing their children? So Prabhupada instantly, I mean, as soon as the man had finished speaking, Prabhupada said, it's not true. He didn't know any, we didn't at that point know any of the facts of what was going on. But Prabhupada immediately, the first thing was, it's not true. Yeah, he was protecting the devotees. So these people, they were accusing the devotees of brainwashing, extortion, and all other kinds of nefarious activities. And eventually the case was brought to court. Now Prabhupada, when he heard about the court cases, he became very enlivened. It was just what he liked. Not that anybody wants trouble, but Prabhupada was, you know, up for it. If they wanted to give us trouble, then we'll give them trouble. And he also saw it as a good opportunity to establish the Krishna consciousness movement as a legal entity and have it accepted as a genuine religion. So he wasn't at all perturbed. He told the GBCs in America and in India, now you immediately start to fight this deprogramming group. He himself also joined in. We were in Vrindavan, and he called all the main priests of all the big temples to a meeting. He explained what was going on, that the devotees were under attack by these so-called deprogrammers. So please help us. You signed this, you know, statement that Krishna consciousness has been going from time immemorial. It's a bona fide religious movement, and they should be left to do what they want to do. So many other temples, they joined in. We signed up some petitions. A short while later, we went down to Hyderabad. The first thing that Prabhupada did when we got to Hyderabad was call all the local priests and mahants to his temple there. And again, he recruited them. So they were all signing, you know, statements saying this is a bona fide religion. So this was Prabhupada's strategy to get as much help as we could get from respectable, recognized religious or spiritual organizations and people. And by March 1977, then the case came to court. So let's see. Prabhupada says here that they were expecting the court case to go on for a long time, and he'd prepared for that also. In January of 77, we were in Bhubaneswar in Jagannath Puri, and we were talking about how to deal with these court cases. Somebody had come from America, I think Tamal Krishna Maharaj, had sent a package of all the you know, the defense statements that were going to be presented. And Prabhupada told his GBC men, he said, now we have a defense statement already. 84 books. All the Srimad Bhagavatam, Nectar of Devotion, Bhagavad Gita, in all the books that Prabhupada had published. He said, present it to the court that this is our defense statement. He said, it will take them years to get through it. So keep them in the court for years on end. We'll continue to get the publicity, and they'll never be able to defeat us. So as he says here, by March of 1977, just a month or two later on, the case did come to court, and surprisingly, he says, the whole court case was finished in one day. I remember at the time, we were spending between $8,000 and $10,000 a month just building up a court case or our defense to the court case. But by the time it came to court, then immediately the judge denied the deprogrammers and established that Krishna consciousness is a bona fide movement with its roots stretching back thousands of years. That was one of the phrases that he used. So he dismissed the case, and from that time on we had a lot less problems. But it was going all over, this idea of deprogramming. So the deprogramming groups in America, they started contacting devotees' parents in places like Australia. So after I left Prabhupada's party in March of 77, one of the first things that we had to do when I got to Australia was to fight one of these deprogramming court cases. And I think, let's see, whilst that was going on, we were also being harassed on another level. Legal level was one thing, but some of these people were so demonic that they were attacking us. So I remember one time in Melbourne, we had our cars parked in the back area of the temple. Somebody threw a stick of dynamite over the back wall. It landed on one of the cars and blew the bonnet off. And there was another time we were all asleep about 12 o'clock at night, and all of a sudden I heard a loud bang. So I jumped up, got out my sleeping bag. I went outside. Nobody else was there. I heard the screeching of tires, you know, like a car that was being gunned. The engine was being gunned. And I looked around. I couldn't see anything. Everything seemed to be normal. But in the morning, one of the ladies that was responsible for cleaning Prabhupada's room, and that was... Yeah, 77. They went into the room, and the whole front windows were all blown in with a shotgun. So somebody had come up to the temple at night time and just took a double-barreled shotgun and blown the whole windows out. And they aimed for that particular room because the light was on. So they were thinking somebody was in there. Actually, it was Prabhupada's room. And he wasn't visiting at that time. But still, this is how, you know, crazy it became. And there was this guy that lived directly behind the temple. There's a small laneway. And on the other side, there was some gentleman and his family. And he hated the devotees so much that he actually put his name up for running for the local council. They were having elections. And his entire platform for complaint, or his, you know, platform for action, was that the Hare Krishnas must be run out of Melbourne. We have to get rid of these people. Of course, when we had the elections, the man lost, and so he gave up, sold his house, and moved somewhere else. But there were all kinds of incidents going on like that. We had a small store in uptown Melbourne. And one of the devotees was an artist, Ram Prasad. So he had done this nice painting on the glass window. You know, they have all the shops, they have glass windows. So he painted a nice kind of motif with groups of lotus flowers growing. So after he painted that, within 3 days, somebody came up and smashed it to pieces. So we were getting a bit of flack. And also, when we went out on the street to distribute books, the police were getting so many complaints. So they also instigated some cases against us. They used to come sometimes in the early morning, say about 6 o'clock, and they would try to capture the devotees and take them to jail. So there was one guy, his real name I forget, but we gave him a nickname called Swedjaw, because he was a little fat guy, And he had, you know, fat people, they tend to have big jowls. So he hardly had a neck because he was so fat. So this man was the head of the council officers in Melbourne. And he was so determined to get rid of the devotees and get them off the street. Because there were laws, and they're still there even now, that you're not allowed to sell books or pamphlets or even give them away without council permission. And of course, we didn't get permission. We just went out and did it. So they would become very angry. And this fellow that was in charge of the council officers, he started, well, what he did first was he memorized all the devotees' names. He knew their legal names. He knew their devotee names. And he also kept a track of how many arrests that we had had. And he would then bring the case to court. And the courts would give some fine, all right, $40, $60, $100, or whatever. So this man spent most of his time running around the streets of Melbourne trying to capture the devotees and get their names and addresses. Then he would take it to court. And of course, we wouldn't attend. Yeah. Prabhupada had told us in 1972, I think it was, we were already having problems in Sydney. So the temple president, Chiru Prabhu, he had written to Prabhupada that we're having these problems every day. They're arresting us. Sometimes we're fined. Sometimes we're put into jail for a few days. What to do? Shall we hire a big lawyer? But if we hire a lawyer, it'll be at least $1,000, you know, fee, and we don't have any money. At that time, actually, in Sydney, we were 3 months behind with the rent, what to speak about anything else. So hiring a big lawyer, we didn't know what to do. So we wrote to Prabhupada. Prabhupada said, don't worry about it. Just go out and do your Sankirtan activities, as you've always done, and let them arrest us. He said, we don't care. And as a P.S. at the end of the letter in his own handwriting, then he put that he said, we can chant in the temple, we can chant on the streets, or we can chant in jail. He said, there's no difference. Just keep on chanting. And eventually, they'll get tired of harassing us. And there have been big problems also in London at one point around that time. The devotees were getting arrested as soon as they set foot on the street. So he said, just like in London, they were harassing us so much, and then we were being arrested, but the public didn't like to see the devotees being arrested. He said, so we should take advantage of that sentiment and go out and chant anyway. If they arrest us, that's all well and good. Then it'll be in the newspapers. Eventually, the police will be embarrassed that they have to they have to arrest us so many times, and then they'll give up. So that's actually what happened. So when we got the letter in Sydney, just go out, doesn't matter, temple, street, jail, it's all the same for a devotee. So we continued on, you know, with our book distribution and chanting. So what the council people did, they sent around two fellows, one with a camera and one with a notebook. And as we were going up and down the main streets chanting, they would stop us just one time a day, and they were going to build up a case against us. So they would ask what our name was, and then they would write down, you know, our legal name also. And in that way, then they were building up like a big folder of people that they wanted to prosecute. We didn't care. We continued on. Prabhupada had told us, just keep on chanting, Krishna will protect you. So we did that. So eventually, when they finally brought the case to court, then first of all, ISKCON at that time in Australia was not a registered society. So they couldn't actually sue or prosecute ISKCON. They could only do individuals. So they had a list of individual names, all the people that should be prosecuted. But the individual names, you know, when they asked us, what's your name, Sonny? Then we would say, Samsara, Prasadam Das. like this. So we give some bogus name. They'd write it down. So when it came to court, then the magistrate, he said, so where are these people? So where is this prasadam des? And then the council officers, they said, well, we don't know. Some of them have left the city. So then the magistrate said, I can only prosecute if they're actually here in court. They have to be allowed, you know, to present the defense. So he just dismissed the whole case. And all we did was just keep on chanting, because Prabhupada has told us, just do that, you'll be okay. So Krishna protected us. That's one practical example. Yeah, and there were many, many others where, you know, we were arrested. Those of you might know Korma Prabhu, the Australian cook. He's got many cookbooks out. He was arrested, and there was a court system. If you owed fines, then if you didn't go to, if you didn't pay the fine, then eventually they had the right to take you to court and sent to jail. So we were all collecting fines, but we weren't paying them. So then that meant the cops could come and arrest us. So several times when we were at the temple in the early morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, all of a sudden the police would arrive, four or five policemen, and Squarejaw, the council officer, he would be with them so that he could, you know, say which ones owed whatever fines that they accumulated. So one morning, my own personal experience, I had been fined. I actually had no idea that I'd been fined. And the police turned up at the temple. And I didn't bother. Well, what we had was a system that if the police came into the temple, they'd come in through the front door, but there was the back door that led onto a laneway. So as soon as the cops turned up, all the devotees that had fines, they would run out through the back door, jump in a van, and go off to the local park and chant their rounds there, and then after an hour they'd come back when the police had gone. So it was a bit of fun and games. But one morning, myself and the temple president, Sanak Prabhu, we thought that we didn't have any fines owing. So I didn't bother jumping in the van and, you know, driving away. We stayed in the temple. But when Squarejaw came, immediately he got me. Said, this is Dennis Harrison. His name is Harry Sauridas. He owes $80 in fines. It was $40 a day. If you didn't do... or if you didn't pay for the fine, then they had the right to arrest you. And the whatever you owed was calculated. You paid it back in jail time at the rate of $40 a day. So I was immediately caught. And Sanak, the temple president, he was caught. He had about 600 or 700 dollars that was owing to the court, so they immediately arrested him, and they took the two of us to the local police station. So we're in the police station for about a day. In the afternoon, the cops came back. They took Sanak away to Pentonville, I think it's called Pentonville Prison. So they took him to the main prison where they put all the, you know, real deviant criminals, hard case criminals. And so he immediately went on a fast, protest fast, and there were some other devotees that had got caught. Korma got caught. He had 8 days worth of fines, so they put him in Pentridge jail, and he also spent about 8 or 10 days in the prison. And then, of course, as soon as we came out, we were back on the streets again. I got caught, but I only had 2 days fines. $40 a day. So that meant that I had to spend just 1 day in the prison. So instead of taking me to the prison, the big prison, they put me in one of the holding cells. They have, you know, like the small police stations dotted around. Each district has its own what they call a watch house. So there's a few prison, a few criminals that are kept there, but they only keep him for one day or 2 days at the most. Then they send him to the main jail. So I only had 1 day's fines. So I had to spend one day and one night in the prison. So in the evening, the police came to the door and he said, you know, we're obliged to feed you whilst you're in the prison. So here's a pie. So I looked at it and I says, but that's a meat pie. He said, yeah. So I said, we can't eat meat. Sorry. So he was a bit put off, but he took the pie away and that was it for that night. Then early in the morning, I was chanting my rounds in the cell, and then another policeman came, and he said, I brought you breakfast, and it was another pie. But he said, this one hasn't got any meat in it, so he expected I would eat it. So I said, no, I'm sorry, I can't eat that. He said, why not? I said, because it's not offered. So the, you know, the police sergeant looked very puzzled. He said, offered? What do you mean it's not offered? I said, yeah, we can't eat anything unless it's offered. He said, but I went down to the store. I bought you a pie. It means he bought it specially just for me, vegetarian pie. I brought it back, and now I'm offering it to you. So I said, no, I said, it has to be offered on the altar to Krishna. Otherwise, we can't eat it. So he grunted. He went off. 5 minutes later, the police sergeant in charge of the watch house, he came. He said, what's this? You're not eating? I said, no, we're not. We can't eat anything that's not offered to Krishna. He said, all right, get out. So he threw me out of the prison. So I had one of the day that I was supposed to do. He just didn't want to deal with it. So he threw me out. So that's a typical kind of scenario that we were facing. That was from, you know, the legal system. There was actually a meeting of all the heads of the city councils. They have it, I think, once a year in Australia. So the mayor of Sydney, the mayor of Melbourne, the mayor of Perth or whatever, all the big cities, they would have an annual meeting just to discuss, you know, any problems that they have or any new things that have come in that they can do for the population. So one year the agenda item was how to get rid of the Hare Krishnas. So anyway, we just kept on going. But it wasn't just from the legal system that we were being harassed. We also had harassment from the parents of devotees. So sometimes, you know, they would come and try and persuade their kids to leave. If they didn't leave, then this deprogramming that Prabhupada mentions, that grew out of, you know, these incidents, that they would come and they would get this legal order, even though their children were actually not children anymore. They were, you know, over 18. But they would get a court order that the parents could ambush or take away their daughter or son, and they would put them in some motel or some other place, some house, and then for 30 days, I forget the name of it, conservatorship or something, there's a legal name for it, but for 30 days they had the legal right to do or say whatever they liked to the devotee, to their devotee's son or daughter. So sometimes, you know, the devotees, they would just sit there and refuse to eat. So they would force them to eat meat, or they would refuse to drink. So they would force them to have alcohol. In this way, they would take pictures of Prabhupada, of, you know, Krishna, or anything to do with Krishna consciousness. They'd rip them up, throw them on the floor, spit on them, stamp on them, anything that they could do within the 30 days to try and prevent us from, you know, being brainwashed. And they would try to deprogram us, means that they felt that we'd been programmed to this unusual behavior by the cult's leaders, and they were just deprogramming us to make us normal again. So they would, you know, do all these horrible things, and sometimes, not very often, it would work. But one of the chief men, what was his name? Ted Patrick, yes. There was one gentleman called Ted Patrick. He was a rather illiterate gentleman, low-class person. And he had attended some meeting at some, it wasn't Hare Krishna, but it was some other Christian group. And after 3 or 4 days, they had converted him to their type of Christianity. And then he got scared that I'd just been converted. And he figured out that actually he figured out that he was being brainwashed and these things were going on against his will. So he started contacting parents of other devotees or whatever organization it was, and he started up this movement, deprogramming movement. And he was on the TV. We had to go on the TV. So it was a big fight. So anyway, as Prabhupada says here, that the devotees will always come out on top because they've got the protection of Krishna. When we heard in Vrindavan, actually in 76, about this deprogramming movement, then Prabhupada just laughed. He said, they're already too late. He said, the poison has already been administered. The fire is already burning. He said, they'll never stop us. Yeah, and so he just told us to keep on going. Didn't matter what happened, but just to keep on chanting, and Krishna would protect us and keep the whole movement going properly. And that's exactly what happened. Eventually, they stopped trying to harass us because they could see that the devotees were fixed. We had absolute faith in Prabhupada. He had absolute faith in Krishna. So whatever they wanted to do, somehow or another, they always lost out. So eventually they did stop their nefarious activities, and we kept on going. There's a punchline to that whole story with this gentleman, Squarejaw, that years and years later, he had retired from the city council. And we have a couple of restaurants in Melbourne on the main street. One is a Gopal's, that one you pay for. And then the other one, that was like a $2 or $5 all you can eat. So people who were in the lower wage bracket, they like to come to this restaurant Crossways, and they get a nice meal and it would be practically free. So one of our devotees, he walked in there one day, and who does he see sitting at one of the tables eating Krishna prasadam but this guy Squarejaw. So he had harassed us for so many years that I think that chanting our name so many times, he was obsessed, get the Hare Krishnas, that eventually it purified him. So that he started, when he retired, he knew that he could get a free meal at the Hare Krishnas. So he was coming every day for his prasadam. So that's the power of devotional service. It's the power of Krishna. It can change people's hearts. And that's what they didn't understand, because they had no understanding about real religion. They were just simply, making a disturbance because they were demons. So these things have to be faced up to sometimes. Devotees sometimes do get harassed. Yeah, we've had so many incidences, like in New Vrindavan. I think in 74, Kirtananda Maharaj was there. The devotees were there. A gang of bikers, they came. They had shotguns. And they ordered Kirtananda Maharaj to dig his own grave. They actually had him digging. And they had guns. Something happened, they had to stop and go away. But that's, devotional service. That whatever happens, a devotee remains firmly fixed at the lotus feet of Krishna, and nobody can budge him from that. Other examples, of course, Prabhupada's given here from the Bhagavatam, Vritrasura, Indradumya, and somebody, Chitraketu. He was cursed to become a demon. by Parvati, and he was smiling when he got the curse. So she was puzzled. You've just cursed him to become a demon, and he's smiling. She said, I've just cursed him to become a demon, and he's simply smiling. And Lord Narayan told her, yes, this is the exalted position of a devotee, that you cannot move him from the lotus feet of the Lord. So when Vritrasura was born, he was the next birth of Chitraketu. So he took birth as a big, ferocious demon. But the interesting thing is, if you read that section, that where he's challenging King Indra to a fight, he's chastising Indra because Indra was getting a little perturbed and afraid. And Vritrasura was chastising him. You call yourself the king of heaven. You call yourself a Kshatriya and you won't fight. He said, come on, fight me. You're destined to kill me anyway. So come and fight me. Let us, you know, do it like gentlemen. So he knew that he was cursed to be, you know, killed at some point. But he invoked, he said, I've got the shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord, so I have no fear. So you also, you should put your faith in the Lord, and he'll sustain you. So even though he got, you know, a birth as a first-class demon, still he remembered his relationship with the Lord. Gajendra is another example. Yeah, the crocodile attacked him, and for 1,000 years they were fighting. Then eventually, Gajendra realized that there's no way I can defeat this crocodile. He's just too strong. And then he remembered that he had spoken a prayer glorifying the Lord in his last lifetime. So somehow or another, because Krishna says, yeah, that he's remember, what's the verse? Krishna says that he's what? Yes, remembrance, forgetfulness, which I'm just exhibiting. Because he had sincerely made this prayer, then Krishna in his heart then enlightened him. First of all, he was just in ignorance, thinking he was the king of the elephants. But when he got defeated, then he remembered by Krishna's grace, it appeared within his heart, this prayer that he'd previously chanted, glorifying the Lord from a previous lifetime. So he started to chant that prayer again. And then, of course, as soon as he did that, he invoked the presence of the Lord, and the crocodile was killed, and the elephant was saved. So it may go on for some time. Yeah, the harassment of a devotee or somebody may cause some trouble. But they can't go on forever. And devotees, they're always under the protection of the Supreme Lord. And they always come out on top. Another example is Bhima. When the Pandavas and the Kurus had grown up, they were young men. So this enmity appeared in the heart of Duryodhan, and especially against Bhima. Bhima was so powerful and strong. Just for fun sometimes, when the Pandavas were fighting, play fighting with the Kauravas, Bhima would chase them up into the trees, and then he would shake the tree and they would drop down like fruit falling off the tree. And he would laugh like anything. So he thought it was all good fun. But the Kurus, of course, they hated it. So Duryodhan wanted to get rid of Bhima as quickly as possible. He was very envious, and he knew with this, the power that Bhima had, they had little chance of defeating him. So they set a trap. They invited him for a feast, and they knew that, because he's called Vrikadar, which means wolf belly, means he can eat any amount of, you know, foodstuffs, and he'll still be hungry. So they told him that we're having a big feast just nearby the riverside. Why don't you come? You're our friend, you're our cousin brother. So Bhima immediately, he was a very kind of innocent kind of person, actually. So he just believed them, oh, feast, very nice. The Kurus are going to have a feast with us. So he went there, and then they fed him with some food, but it had poison in it. So as soon as he took that foodstuffs, he fell unconscious from the poison. And next to the river, in the water, kind of low enough down so you couldn't see them from the surface, the carvers had put these wooden stakes, yeah, with sharp points. And by throwing Bhima in the river, they hoped that he would be pierced by these wooden stakes and killed. So they threw him in. But unfortunately for them, he missed all the wooden stakes. Then some snakes came, poisonous snakes, because he was intruding in there where they lived. So they started biting him like anything, many snakes, serpents. But all that did was counteract the poison that Duryodhana had already given him. So he came back to consciousness, and then he stayed there because he was recognized, this is Bhima. So I think, was it Vasuki? The smaller snakes took Bhima to Vasuki, and he said, oh, this is one of the Pandavas, this is Bhima. So he's, you know, he's a good man, we should feed him. So they fed him some special elixir. So one pot of this elixir, then it would make you as strong as 10,000 elephants. So they knew Bhima was very, very powerful, so they decided to give him, you know, more of this elixir and make him even more powerful. So he took one jug of it, and that was enough to kill an ordinary man. But he was, you know, he was very happy. Oh, that was really good. He got any more. So they gave him another pot. He drank all that. They gave him another pot. He drank all that. Each time he drank a pot of this elixir, he became 10,000 times stronger. So he had 8 pots. And then at the end of the 8th one, he said, oh, I feel a little tired now. I'll take rest. So he went to sleep. And then afterwards, he went to sleep for 8 days. Whatever. Anyway, eventually he woke up and he said, I have to return now to my brothers. So out he came. Duryodhana was astonished. The Kauravas were astonished. Bhima, who they thought was dead because they hadn't seen him for so many days, was now back amongst them. So that way, even when the Kauravas had, you know, the strength and power, it appeared that the Pandavas were in a very weak position, somehow or another, Krishna would arrange things so that they would survive and get stronger and stronger. So this is, you know, a typical position of a pure devotee, that they're always under the protection of the Supreme Lord. Whatever happens, ultimately Krishna will arrange just so that the devotees will come out on top. There's the story of Jayadrath also, another rascal. He had tried to kidnap, what was it, Draupadi, was it? Yes. So he got chased off by the Pandavas. But Arjuna, when he found out, he made a promise that he was going to kill, I think this is right, Jayadrath, right? But on that particular day of the war at Kurukshetra, that he said, if he's not killed by the end of the day, when the sun goes down, I'll kill myself. So the Kauravas were very happy because they felt confident. They had all the big players still alive. They felt confident that they could, my brain's a little out of whack at the moment. That they felt confident that they could protect Jayadrath. So they made this needle formation, military formation, and it stretched over a very long, you know, area. And Krishna and Arjuna had to fight their way through each section of the, you know, the division of the of the Kauravas. So it was very difficult to do. Even Krishna, he chastised Arjuna, why you made that promise without telling me first? I would have never have, you know, advised you to do this, but now you've given your promise, we have to do it. So eventually it took them all day, but they finally got to the place where Jayadrath was. The Kauravas had, you know, put in formation after formation to protect Jayadrath. Jayadrath was at the other end, and the fighting was all at the front. But somehow or another, Arjuna and Krishna, they fought their way all through the, you know, phalanx of the other army. But by the time they got to within sight of Jayadrath, it was sunset. And the sun was just going down, and Krishna knew that now any second the sun is going to disappear, Jayadrath, you know, will be victorious and Arjuna will have to kill himself. So the Kauravas had also seen that the sun was now coming down and almost settled, and what to do. So Krishna made an arrangement with his Sudarsan disc to keep the sun up for 1 or 2 seconds longer. He stopped it from going over the horizon. And in that 1 or 2 seconds, then they saw Jayadrath at the end. And then immediately he sent his arrows and killed him. So even though the opposing party was certain Jayadrath would get through, they had the strength, you know, even Krishna wouldn't be able to do anything, but Krishna did something and he protected his devotee. So there's many stories like that, because they're in the Bhagavatam. These stories are coming down from thousands of years. But as we've already explained, even in an age like this, Kali Yuga, where everybody's demonic, everybody's short, they have no strength, they have no intelligence, they cause so many trouble for the devotees, but somehow or another the devotees always will come out on top. And this is one example, this deprogramming court case, the Prabhupada cites that the devotees will always be victorious. When he got this news that this case had been found in our favor, he was in ecstasy. I had just left Prabhupada's personal service about a week before the case came to court. Prabhupada wrote to me and he said, now you can see that the courts have found in our favor. This is Krishna's mercy. Just see how he protects his devotees. So anyway, that was a nice occurrence. Okay, so it's getting late. Does anybody have any questions or comments? No? Yes, Frank Hunter. The Vaikuntha is saying that this Ted Patrick, who had organized or was helping to organize the deprogrammers in America, he actually got arrested himself on some charge and was jailed for 1 year. So that's another respite. Krishna made the arrangement. Okay, so we'll finish there. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.